Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Wednesday, President Obama outlined his proposals for gun control. Among them, a request to Congress for $10 million to study the impact of media on violence, with a specific reference to video games.
And Congress should fund research into the effects that violent video games have on young minds. We don't benefit from ignorance. We don't benefit from not knowing the science of this epidemic of violence.
You'd think that there would be a heap of academic studies on the effect of violent video games, and actually there are more than 100. Jason Schreier, reporter for the gaming website Kotaku, took a look at many of those studies and the meta-analyses of those studies and found that they may not study what we're looking for, like the connection between violent video games and criminally violent behavior.
You can't put a kid in front of a video game and then give him a gun or a knife and see what he does with it. You just can't do that. So what researchers are looking for is a link between violent video games and aggression, which in general means hostile behavior that isn't criminal. So it might be a kid bullying another kid in school.
And what have the studies found in that area?
If you ask Chris Ferguson, a professor at Texas A&M, who's one leading researcher on the subject, he'll say they've found nothing. There's too many variables, there's too many factors, there's not enough good research. If you ask Brad Bushman, a professor at Ohio State University, who is also a leading researcher on the subject, he'll say, we found a conclusive link between video games and aggression.
For those who find the link between aggression and video game playing inconclusive, what's their problem with the studies, with the methodology?
A lot of these studies are looking at college students and not young children. And these college students, they're going to be taking classes on psychology, on media violence, hearing theories about media violence. Sometimes these college students will guess what they're supposed to do, and they'll do it. Another possible factor is that the methods for testing aggression are not ideal. One of them, for example, is a student will go into a room and be told that he or she has to administer a certain level of this awful, unpleasant noise that sounds like nails scratching against the chalkboard or something like that.
You're talking about administering this nasty noise to a fellow student who must be, quote-unquote, punished.
Right, and these test subjects have to choose how intense the noise is, how loud it is. And they found in some of these studies that students who play violent video games will, on average, dole out more of this awful noise than students who play nonviolent video games.
These are students who are playing games right before they're asked to dole out the punishment, or just in their lives?
Right beforehand. That brings up another interesting question, which is short-term versus long-term effects, which is something that Chris Ferguson also believes has not been studied. He's found that some of these studies are so flexible that researchers can wind up picking and choosing outcomes that fit whatever hypothesis they're going for.
On the other hand, Ohio State University professor Brad Bushman, while conceding that, quote, no researcher I know would say violence in the media is the only risk factor for aggression or violence, or that it's the most important factor, it is one factor, and it's one that we can do something about.
What Brad Bushman did is, in 2010, he ran what's called a meta-analysis, which is an analysis that looks at a whole bunch of different studies. They concluded that, yes, there is a link between violent video games and aggression. Chris Ferguson, the biggest critic of Bushman's results, also did a meta-analysis where he found similar results to Bushman. That, yeah, there was a link, but they both look at that same data and disagree on what it means. What Ferguson actually told me was, it's really a question of, do violent video games have no effect, or do they have a very insignificant effect?
So Ferguson may be willing to concede that there is an effect, but that it's insignificant.
He believes that we don't know right now if there's an effect, but if there is an effect at all, it's very insignificant.
Now, another researcher who threw a spanner in the works that you mentioned is Paul Adachi, who tried to measure not just whether violent video games make people more aggressive, but whether competitive games do. So he took his study group and he exposed them to four kinds of games: nonviolent competitive games, violent competitive games, violent non-competitive games, and nonviolent non-competitive games.
What Polodacci found in his study is that the people who were playing competitive games, whether it was violent or nonviolent, would still get an increase in aggression. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that violence isn't a factor, but it means that competition is also a factor.
Last year, the Supreme Court struck down a law that would have made it a crime for stores to sell violent games to kids because, quote, most of the studies suffer from significant admitted flaws in methodology. Can we come to a conclusion about any of this?
Chris Ferguson brought up a really interesting point that I agree with, and he said, science is a human endeavor. The more someone tells me that they're absolutely objective, the less I believe they are. So people need to fact-check things. They need to understand that science is easily damaged by politics and personal opinion.
Well, that's helpful. Jason, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Brooke.
Jason Schreier is a reporter for Kotaku. The massacre in Newtown sparked the current debate, but usually when a child falls victim to gun violence, it's not in a comfortable suburb, and its coverage is confined to the Metro page. At New York Public Radio, our producing station, reporter Kathleen Horan's current assignment is to profile every child killed by a gun in New York City. Her series is called In Harm's Way. In September, she profiled Kayim Vieira, a 17-year-old Queens teenager who died after being shot multiple times in an altercation.
Less than 3 miles and 14 years apart, Kayim was shot and killed, like his father, on the streets of Brooklyn. Tyree blames herself.
My son became another statistic, and that was something I said he would never be. My son would not be a statistic.
Horan says everyone sees these deaths on the news, but the stories all look the same.
You see the picture of the yellow police tape. You see that the kid had a record or was shot in the head or was part of a gang or was killed by masked gunmen. What aren't they saying? Even if all of those details are true, this kid had a parent who was a social worker, or this kid wanted to be a marine biologist. This kid was a tough guy, but his mom washed his face.
Even though he was the master of his own style, stood 5'10", and wore size 13 sneakers, he wasn't too big to be babied.
He would let me, but then he'd get mad, like if his brothers is around. Because if they have an argument, they'd say, that's why mommy brushing your teeth.
The things that I'm surprised about, I flag those things, and I think, okay, you know, you're going in search of a person you'll never meet. So you just try to talk to the people that can help you construct that person.
How'd you get picked for this assignment?
Our criminal justice reporter was leaving, and I had already been in discussions with our news director that I would possibly be working on this project. And then also, I've done a lot of different obituaries and profiles of people that have died. There's something about endings and me, I guess. You know, having that beginning, middle, and an end, there is something, as a reporter, that's very rich about that. And it can be obviously sad, but there's so many possibilities.
Are there any common threads that leap out from these stories?
The common threads you'd find in those statistics. They're young, black and brown men, usually. They're also usually murdered by young black or brown men. Most of the kids that I've profiled lived in public housing.
And you want to make sure they're not a statistic. Nevertheless, some of the kids that you've profiled have had some involvement with crime or with gangs. How do you address that without distracting listeners from the story of the individual human being?
Well, there's the facts and then there's the essence. There's that thing that made them different than any other kid. Even if they're in a gang or even if they have an arrest record, there's still so many details that you just wouldn't expect.
He's in a shower, sleep.
How does that work? How do you sleep in the shower?
He sits down and he runs the water.
Yes, he does.
Every morning.
It was that passion for water that made him want to become a marine biologist.
He always used to look out this window. It's a swan in the water. Look how big that swan is. I think everything was like more amazing to him. He wanted to study about it.
Kathleen, we've known each other for a decade. This summer, maybe early fall, you had just started this project, and you were telling me about it very calmly on the subway, and then you just fell apart. How do you deal with the pain?
I'm still figuring that out by taking them one at a time. It's such an assignment that I feel so glad to be working on. It's so powerful for me, not just as a journalist, but as a human being, that it's worth the kind of process that I've been going through. And I think maybe I'll get better at dealing with it.
She says when she got to Brookdale Hospital, Ronald was in surgery. And within a few minutes, she was informed he was dead.
I was so angry, so hurt inside. Like, who could do that to my Jeff? He's not that kind of kid. Nobody understands what I'm going through. I'm hurt. My heart is hurt.
A month before Ronald was shot, Orr says she called the city housing authority. She was worried about her children's safety and wanted a transfer, but says she was denied.
I think that trying to piece together who these people were as best as I can, and I go and I sit with their parents, and I walk the streets that they walked, and I go into their bedrooms, and I talk to the people that loved them, it's just hard not to have them pass through me a little bit.
Do you have another one you're working on right now?
I do. I'm not sure the mother wants to participate, so this is the first time that that's happened, but it makes sense. Not everyone's going to want to participate.
Where was he?
He was on the Lower East Side. We've talked briefly. She said she was with him. They were talking. They said goodbye. In the time it took her to get to her car, in 10 minutes, he had been shot across the street from their housing complex. She's really angry.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you, Brooke.
Kathleen Horan covers criminal justice for WNYC. Since we recorded that interview, the mother that Kathleen was hoping to interview agreed to speak with her. You can find a link to it on our website.
Coming up, how two famous athletes and one famous police agency have played the media.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We now know what almost everyone has suspected for some time. Lance Armstrong is a liar and a bully and a cheat. Despite a chorus of accusations and an exhaustive report by the United States Anti-Doping Agency, Armstrong long claimed he never took performance-enhancing drugs in winning his 7 Tour de France titles. Along the way, Armstrong intimidated journalists, sued an English newspaper for libel and got a $500,000 settlement, and accused other riders of trying to destroy him. We recorded this interview on Thursday night after the first of 2 interviews on the Oprah Winfrey Network, in which Armstrong, at long last, confesses.
I view this situation as one big lie.
Our friend Mike Pesca covers sports for NPR. Hey, Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
There's a very prominent journalist named Buzz Bissinger who made a very high-profile fool of himself by supporting Lance Armstrong in print on more than one occasion. He calls Armstrong an immoral, manipulative liar who doesn't deserve a second more of anybody's time. So don't waste it by watching him on Thursday. You watched, Mike, apart from the gripping experience of watching a sociopath confess, do you think you wasted your time?
No, we got the official confession. We haven't had that before. And so maybe some of the people who are underlining how disappointing this was have forgotten the fact that it was just a useful exercise to get on the record Oprah's stream of yes or no questions where she established that he cheated for every one of those Tour de France titles.
Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
Was one of those banned substances EPO?
Yes.
Did you ever blood dope or use blood transfusions to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
His confession was not one employing weasel words and legalisms. It was close to being unequivocal. Did that surprise you?
Well, I guess in the face of this overwhelming evidence, he couldn't have employed a weasel word or said, "if I offended anybody." On the other hand, the psychology of it was constructed in a self-serving way. You know, he at one point early on in the interview talked about how I lost myself in this whole process. And that's fairly typical of a serial cheat, that they kind of convinced themselves that this wasn't the real me doing it.
The televised confession has become a genre unto itself. And one of the explanations for him finally coming clean, if he did that, was redemption. I'm going to play you a little montage.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong.
I apologize to everybody in Major League Baseball, my family, but Selig, today was the hardest day of my life.
To my fellow television ministers and evangelists, please forgive me for sinning against you.
If the goal is not PR, but actual redemption. Halfway into this process, what kind of progress do you think Armstrong has made?
I think to some extent, what Armstrong was trying to do is a little different from the rest of the people that you heard from. Bill Clinton successfully tried to rescue his presidency and rehab his career, and so now he's a respected player on the world stage. And Mark McGwire pretty much knew he was never going to get into the Hall of Fame, but essentially just wanted to do enough to get a job as a batting coach. And I think Swaggart, more than anything, wanted to think of himself as a moral man. I think what Armstrong wants to do is get his lifetime ban lifted so that he could participate in triathlons. And so I don't know if it's absolution that Oprah could give, but maybe he internally views what he's doing as one of those stations of the cross to get there to reach his end goal.
It will have been in the second half that Oprah confronts him with speculation that such as you just offered about trying to open up a window for some sort of future career in sports.
Yeah.
What do you think about her performance as an interviewer? This was not particularly warm and fuzzy.
Right. I'll read something that Jason Gay, columnist with the Wall Street Journal, wrote. He was saying that people who are following pro cycling reach their own conclusions. I don't think they're expecting Oprah Winfrey to ask about hematocrit levels and the Tour of Switzerland. Well, she did ask about the Tour of Switzerland. At times, she got into a really nice level of detail. What I would like as a sports journalist is different than what she's going to deliver, and she's probably right for her audience. This was an interview from Lance's perspective for rehabilitation and for Oprah's perspective to get her audience to understand what happened in the arc of this human being. And I think she did that well.
Can we trade highlights? Tell me what was your favorite moment, and then I'll tell you mine.
Well, I think it was when they brought up Emma O'Reilly, who is really just a masseuse and an assistant and a victim of Lance's vitriol when she chose to kind of go forward with the truth. He did imply that she was a whore, basically. He also implied that she was a drunken whore. And Oprah said, you know, not only did you say those things about her, you sued her. And he kind of had a blank look on his face, said, did I? You know, I kind of sued so many people. It's really hard to keep them straight. I thought that was pretty good.
Now, here's mine. It happened in the first maybe 4 minutes. Armstrong talked about the code name that he and his teammates had to describe the doping. And it was an anagram of EPO, the oxygen-boosting drug that they were using. And their code name was POE. Sound familiar to you?
No.
Okay, listen.
POE. Purity of essence.
It's some sort of recurrent theme he kept repeating. It's a variation on peace on earth or purity of essence.
Purity of essence. It was the callback code for the nuclear strike in Dr. Strangelove.
Ah.
It was the cause of nuclear conflagration.
And here I have this picture of Lance, like Slim Pickens, riding that bomb into the entire sport of cycling.
Mike, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Bob.
Mike Pesca covers sports for NPR. On Wednesday morning, Manti Te'o was best known as a star football player at Notre Dame, a probable NFL first-round draft pick, and the college athlete with the world's most compelling backstory.
What makes his performance all the more remarkable is that he did it while enduring almost unimaginable anguish. Last September, his beloved grandmother died of cancer. And on the same day, just hours later, his girlfriend, Lene Kakua, died after a long battle with leukemia.
Mateo's athletic prowess and the odds he'd overcome put him on ESPN and on the cover of Sports Illustrated beneath the headline, The Full Manti. The story of the tragic, remarkable linebacker resounded outside the sports press, picked up by national outlets such as CBS News, The New York Times, and the Associated Press. It had all the melodrama of a perfect Friday Night Lights plotline.
Teo says she asked him not to attend her funeral, telling him, "Babe, if anything happens to me, you promise that you'll stay there and you'll play and you'll honor me through the way you play." And that is what he did.
In the close win against Michigan, Teo intercepted two passes. And he did it on the same day that Lene was buried.
I literally felt them with me.
And then Wednesday night, the sports feature website Deadspin posted an expose which asked readers, did you enjoy the uplifting story, the tale of a man who responded to adversity by becoming one of the top players of the game? If so, stop reading.
Deadspin reported that Lene Kukua, the girlfriend, was a hoax, easily debunked using the most basic tools of journalism. There was no obituary, no sign of her in the registrar at Stanford, her supposed college, nor mention of her in the school newspaper, no birth record for that matter. The only evidence she'd existed was a flimsy social media presence, posted pictures, supposedly of her, but actually of a 22-year-old, unaware of the hoax. Pete Thamel, the Sports Illustrated reporter who wrote the cover story that helped mint the legend, went on the Dan Patrick Sports radio show to explain why he fell for it. There was so much detail, he said, that it didn't occur to him that it could be a big lie.
Well, when those little red flags, oh, she didn't show up in Nexus, oh, I can't find her brother's name to spell check it, like, it just... You know, you were able to write around it because you had a whole football team, university community, and country. She'd been, quote-unquote, dead for a week by the time I got there.
Now, both Notre Dame and Manti Te'o himself have released statements saying that they were hoaxed by a third party and only learned that the girlfriend was fictional last month. Of course, to believe that, you have to believe that Te'o only communicated with her over the phone and online, even though his father described in detail in the South Bend Tribune the moment that Te'o and Kukua first met in person. So now the media are awash in speculation about whether Te'o was a victim or a perpetrator or some combination of the two, and also awash in hand-wringing over this latest high-profile example of major media outlets passing along bad information because other media outlets did it first. But probably it was inevitable because, as in the Lance Armstrong case, it met the ever-present expectation of the audience for a feel-good story that transcends mere sport. Yes, at best, Manti Te'o was a sucker, and the news organizations that unquestionably passed along the story were suckers too. But of course, so were we, so eager to swallow that bittersweet saga because it tasted so good.
I want to make something absolutely clear. There's nobody else coming to the rescue. There is just us.
That's a scene from the acclaimed and controversial movie Zero Dark Thirty. 2 weeks ago, former CIA Deputy Director Jose A. Rodriguez Jr. wrote a Washington Post op-ed to clarify, among other things, the film's depiction of waterboarding. Instead of large buckets of water, he says, small plastic bottles were used to enhancedly interrogate jihadists. Putting aside whether torture is somehow less torturous because of the smaller containers and the now discredited claim that waterboarding yielded intelligence on bin Laden's whereabouts, Rodriguez was looking a gift horse in the mouth. For the CIA, Zero Dark Thirty has been a PR bonanza. According to journalist Ted Gupp, the episode and the film itself reflect an agency increasingly willing to reveal operational secrets when convenient, while keeping strictly mum on matters that may embarrass or incriminate it.
The agency employs a double standard when it comes to secrecy. The problem is that by applying the rules of secrecy inconsistently, people who run afoul of their arbitrariness can find themselves ensnared in a world of hurt, and the public can become very confused by the pictures that emerge. You know, there was an editor years and years ago of the New York Times named Scotty Reston, and he would say that government is the only vessel that leaks from the top. And I think that's part of the problem. that the CIA has a director and it has its senior people who, when it suits them, will speak with the press on background for guidance. But woe to those who will speak to the press and raise questions or be critical of what the agency is doing.
Then there's the John Kiriakou case, an ex-CIA officer who is going to jail for revealing to a journalist information that never even found its way into print.
Right. John Kiriakou, I believe, was accused of providing the name of someone who was undercover to someone in the press. That person in the press did not disclose the identity of that operative. I think about all of the former covert operatives who have provided me with the names and identities of sources for stories I've worked on whose cover had not been lifted. And my colleagues in the press, we have all been the recipients of these sorts of leaks. None of us, to my knowledge, have ever knowingly disclosed the identity of those people, and none of those sources, to my knowledge, have ever been prosecuted. So I think the reason that Mr. Kiriakou came into the crosshairs of the agency may have had less to do with the information he imparted to a member of the press and more to do with the fact that he had run afoul of them earlier by being an outspoken critic of waterboarding.
We are, as you pointed out in your piece, simply awash in intelligence nonfiction, sometimes from journalists such as yourself, sometimes from ex-CIA, sometimes collaborations of the two. You've said that as a society, we should probably be pleased that we have a window into this murky world. But I can't help but wondering when I read these books whether somehow this isn't itself part of some ongoing op and journalists have been co-opted and the public has been somehow tricked.
I definitely think you're onto something there. I think I saw a significant shift beginning in the 90s where the agency's concern for its public image here at home became increasingly expressed and its campaign to win over the American public increasingly sophisticated. And that's when you saw this profusion of memoirs written by former operatives. I saw a tremendous amount of leaking, and I know that my colleagues in the press have as well. They have their own liaison in Hollywood who works with filmmakers when the films are deemed not to be overtly hostile to the agency. Over the last 20 years, the agency that once simply invoked neither confirm nor deny has become something of a spigot for stories that continually flow to the press. And you know that in the old days, and I'm talking about the 50s and 60s, such things would never have been tolerated.
Getting back to Zero Dark Thirty, it was revealed long before the movie premiered that the filmmakers enjoyed special access to the inside dope on the operation, courtesy of the CIA. And some GOP members in the House, and I think Senate, went nuts because they considered it a serious breach of national security. I'm curious, given your ambivalence, do you think those legislators were right?
My recollection is that at least a part of the motivation of the GOP legislators who objected to the special access accorded to the makers of Zero Dark Thirty was rooted in concern that it would have potentially a political impact on the elections that were imminent, the fear that it would depict President Obama as a commanding figure, a heroic figure. But if their consternation was rooted principally or exclusively in a concern for consistency in the application of secrecy, then I'd have to say I'm probably with them. This is another example of special access eroding the credibility of the agency's invocations of secrecy.
This program institutionally has a huge bias towards transparency. But I think it's probably fair to say that covering the CIA is not like covering the local school board. A reporter has to consider all sorts of consequences, not only for national security, but for the security of your sources.
As a journalist, I profoundly embrace transparency. And I do think that there's a legitimate need for the American citizens, in broad strokes at least, to understand what the agency does On the other hand, as a citizen, I want the CIA to recognize that the central credo of its work, espionage, is to be conducted in the shadows and not to be subject to the same rules of transparency. It is, in our democratic system, a distinct anomaly, and the contradictions and conflicts that I feel, I think, are shared by many. There were materials provided to me over the course of the last 15, 20 years that I didn't publish, even though they would have made good stories, because I invoked the rule, when in doubt, leave it out.
Ted, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ted Gupp is a fellow at Harvard's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics and author of The Book of Honor, Covert Lives and Classified Deaths at the CIA.
Coming up, the death of a hacker who tried to make information free.
If we lost the ability to communicate with each other over the internet, it would be a change to the Bill of Rights, the freedoms guaranteed in our Constitution, the freedoms our country had been built on, would be suddenly deleted.
Also, we consider how intellectual property laws have ensured that using Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is not free.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, offering a new professional service to help manage business reputations, ratings, and reviews on the internet. More at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late last week, 26-year-old hacker, programmer, and activist Aaron Swartz hanged himself. He had a history of depression and faced federal prosecution for hacking MIT's computer network to run a script that would download millions of academic articles. In his teens, he was already a force in the open internet movement, and he never let up.
There's a battle going on right now, a battle to define everything that happens on the internet in terms of traditional things that the law understands. Is sharing a video on BitTorrent like shoplifting from a movie store? Or is it like loaning a videotape to a friend? Is reloading a web page over and over again like a peaceful virtual sit-in or a violent smashing of shop windows?
But his commitment to an open internet landed him in serious legal trouble when he was arrested for downloading millions of articles from the online article repository JSTOR. Over JSTOR's own objections, a federal prosecutor charged Swartz with wire fraud, computer fraud, unlawfully obtaining information from a protected computer, and more. Adrian Chen wrote an article for Gawker called "The Death of Aaron Swartz and the New Hacker Crackdown."
He was an activist, he was a writer, and he was a builder who created all sorts of programs, large and small. Most notably, he was one of the original programmers behind Reddit, the social news site. So he was really kind of a Renaissance man of the digital age.
His willingness to commit civil disobedience has led some to liken him to Henry David Thoreau.
This was not his first time having a brush with the law. In 2008, he downloaded millions of documents from Pacer, the online court document system, and faced an investigation that actually didn't end up in charges. Anybody who's done any research using Pacer knows that it's incredibly clunky and it charges you for every document you download. So essentially, it's just a huge hassle to get these documents that should be public knowledge.
Describe the JSTOR case.
Well, JSTOR was kind of an obvious target, I think, for somebody like Swartz. JSTOR is a massive database of academic research. It's a nonprofit that was set up by a consortium of universities to store all of this research and charges access fees to different institutions.
It's not cheap.
No, it's definitely something that, you know, an individual can't afford. So he is accused of downloading 4 million documents, something like 33 gigabytes of academic articles, and prosecutors allege that he was going to upload them to file sharing websites.
But ultimately, he gave those articles back to JSTOR. JSTOR said that it had, quote, no interest in this becoming an ongoing legal matter. But the federal prosecutors felt very differently.
It really gets to the heart of a conflict that has been going on since the beginning of the internet, which is, what is the internet for? On the one hand, you have people like Swartz and hacktivists like Anonymous who believe that It should just be a place where information is completely free. Anybody can access it. And then on the other hand, you have people like Ortiz, the federal prosecutor, and JSTOR that need a more orderly internet where information is actually protected and people who try to liberate information are punished. Federal prosecutors are really trying to crack down on that, and any kind of computer crime like this is something that's going to be a big target for them.
So they wanted to make an example of him.
Yes.
What sorts of penalties did he potentially face, and what was he likely to face?
He potentially faced as many as 35 years in prison and $1 million in fines. It turned out that he had been offered a plea deal for just 6 months in prison. He would have still had to plead guilty to 13 felony charges. I think a lot of the public outcry over this has been over the maximum sentence and the maximum penalties. And one of the things that's come out of this is a movement to reform laws so that people wouldn't face such harsh penalties for what Aaron Swartz did.
So tell me, what has resulted from his death so far?
Immediately after his death, a petition went up on the White House site to remove Carmen Ortiz, the head of the office that prosecuted him, and it got tens of thousands of signatures in a matter of days. One of the more concrete things that's happened is that a representative introduced something called Aaron's Law to limit the penalties and try to avoid a disproportionate punishment like Aaron was facing. But I think it goes bigger than just prosecutorial overreach. It gets to this fight over what the internet's supposed to look like. Another thing that's happened on Twitter mostly is that academics have been posting PDFs of their academic work in honor of Swartz and his cause of liberating this information. They've used a hashtag PDF tribute.
Adrian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adrian Chen is a writer for Gawker.
If we lost the ability to communicate with each other over the internet, it would be a change to the Bill of Rights, the freedoms guaranteed in our Constitution, the freedoms our country had been built on, would be suddenly deleted. New technology, instead of bringing us greater freedom, would have snuffed out fundamental rights we'd always taken for granted.
Late in the afternoon of August 28, 1963, a young preacher stepped to the podium on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and looked out over the assembled crowd. Then Martin Luther King Jr. did what many preachers do, but never quite so memorably. Using a blueprint he'd prepared in advance, he built a sermon.
I am happy to join.
The circumstances were exceptional. 250,000 people, a time tactically chosen, a show of strength and purpose, an implicit threat. But for King, it came down to a moment and a process he'd spent a lifetime learning, how to borrow and transform the work of others. To mark Martin Luther King Day, we're replaying a piece that examines precisely that process, this from On the Media's Jamie York.
Working from his notes, King started moving quickly through themes and invocations he'd used many times before, starting with the Emancipation Proclamation and the Gettysburg Address, a reference to the Gospel of Matthew, and by the fourth paragraph, the idea of the uncashed check. This was an idea invoked most recently by James Baldwin and Malcolm X, the check uncashed, a debt still owed.
In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note.
Then King moved on, deploying the full range of his voice through a series of references to Gandhi's soul power, back to the Bible, repeating key phrases and pausing to hear the crowd's response, so he could react accordingly. In those pauses, he came to grips with the conclusion he'd outlined in his notes, and around minute 11, he decided to improvise.
He's able to sit there, listen to what the crowd is saying, and realize that his conclusion is terrible. I mean, it's not going to work.
Drew D. Hansen is author of an analysis of the speech entitled The Dream.
And so right there, he's looking out at the crowd. Mahalia Jackson's behind him saying, tell them about the dream, Martin. Tell them about the dream, Martin. And he looks up from his text and says, and so I say to you today, my brethren, so even though we must face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream.
It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream.
And Clarence Jones is one of his aides, one of his speechwriters, is looking at, he's following along with the text, and he looks up at that point and goes, he's off now. He He's on his own now. And he just flies.
My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
On the one hand, King had acted on a spark of inspiration, and on the other, was employing a skill he'd practiced and honed. What many scholars believe King did in that moment was to abandon his written remarks and draw on one of hundreds of ideas, references, and sources that he'd committed to memory. In this case, an idea he'd been workshopping in front of audiences. The idea of a dream, a prophecy, joined with the riff on the song America, My Country, Tis of Thee, with lyrics Samuel F. Smith wrote in 1831.
This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, My Country, Tis of Thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my...
There was a tradition of referencing the song's irony in the face of racism. Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois had both done it. But King wasn't going that far back. King was recalling a speech black judge and clergyman Archibald Cary had given 11 years prior at the Republican National Convention. Another memorable riff on America by Samuel F. Smith.
There's no question, you look at the two together, King's depending on that as his source. I mean, in some speech, King talks about how he gets this line from, quote, a great orator, close quote. I mean, he doesn't try to hide it. But then you look at what King does, and the material's totally different. I mean, Cary talks about the green mountains and white mountains of Vermont and New Hampshire. Well, that's a handful of words if you ever saw one. King makes it the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, right? He gets the internal rhyme on the short I of prodigious and hilltops. It's this nice, quick little phrase. I mean, there's no repeated phrase in Cary's original. Well, King takes it and he puts in, let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire.
Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania.
He'd spend his entire life studying techniques of preaching. And for the rest of his life, I mean, he and his friends from seminary kept on this running correspondence about the preacher's art. I mean, one of them would write to him and say, hey, I tried the ladder sermon where you take an idea and you gradually increase the level of your examination at it, or the jewel sermon where you look at a theme from a number of different angles, like facets of a jewel. Rabbit in the bushes, where if you start going on an idea and you feel the audience responding, then you keep shooting at it, just like a hunter would keep shooting at the bushes when he sees them rustle to see if there's a rabbit in there.
Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
But what are the ethics of constructing your sermons from the raw material of any ideas you encounter? Keith Miller is the author of Voice of Deliverance, The Language of Martin Luther King Jr. and Its Sources.
There were hundreds of books of sermons published by liberal Protestants before 1950, 1960. And in my research, I traced not only King's use of sources, but these preachers were borrowing from each other. So you can read one book of sermons and there's a quotation from Shakespeare, and you might think that the person was standing up all night reading Shakespeare, but actually the same quotation from Shakespeare shows up in book after book after book of sermons by different people.
And that's just the references found in the published sermons of white and black preachers. King, of course, came out of a parallel oral tradition of African-American preaching.
There's a long tradition of African-American folk preaching starting in slavery. Most slaves were forbidden by law to learn how to read and write. So they developed this oral tradition of songs and sermons, and some of the sermons during slavery were still being preached in the 30s, 40s, and 50s and were recorded on blues labels and sold. Somebody would find an unusual piece of scripture that people hadn't used much before, and then they float from one book of sermons to another, and one imagines from one oral sermon to another in different contexts.
King saw the whole world as his source book. He didn't make some great fine distinctions between what was his originally and what was someone else's. He would take the material and he would transform it into his own, no matter where it came from.
Preaching, then, is an art whose first and foremost aim is to exalt God and move those in the pews. King used his oratory to construct common ground, drawing on references to political and religious morality that spoke to both blacks and whites. But the rules of preaching are in profound conflict with the rules governing intellectual property. King himself copyrighted the I Have a Dream speech in 1963. He directed all proceeds to the civil rights movement. But since his death, his estate, first his widow and now his children, have struggled with how to apply the law to King's legacy. Lewis Hyde is the author of Common as Air, Revolution, Art, and Ownership. He says it's a real puzzle deciding how to treat Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous speech.
Whether it should be a public, like a public park open to all of us, or whether it's a piece of private real estate that it's appropriate to charge fees to enter. I guess I first knew about this because it came up in regard to the famous civil rights documentary, Eyes on the Prize. And in that instance, you find one case in which people wanted to use Martin Luther King's speaking and image and found it difficult to clear the rights for a reasonable amount of money.
Eyes on the Prize is but one example of King's estate monetizing and restricting access to King's written words, speeches, and likeness. Likewise, the estate has sued or demanded steep fees from academics, journalists, and news organizations, charging intellectual property violations. And almost without exception, they've won.
Martin Luther King's heirs have treated his created work as a commercial property. They have used King's work, sold it to advertisers. One example is a cell phone company.
A cell phone ad from 2000 in which King's speech is juxtaposed with Kermit the Frog and Homer Simpson.
And so this is a reformulation of King's image and message, moving it from the political and spiritual sphere in which it began into a completely commercial sphere.
Before you can inspire,
we hold these truths to be self-evident.
Before you can touch,
that all men are created equal.
You must first connect. And the company that connects more of the world is Alcatel, a leader in communication networks.
Hyde makes the point that the snippet of that speech that was sold to Alcatel is only 65% King's. The rest of the words are Thomas Jefferson's. No one I spoke to disputes that the King family have every legal right to make a living from the estate they've inherited. And where the line of commercialism should be drawn is a complicated debate. A 2008 study found that the speech was more recognizable to Americans than any other, and 97% of American teenagers recognize the words as King's. But authors like Michael Eric Dyson, author of I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King Jr., fear that the recognition is actually counterproductive if documentarians, journalists, and researchers are denied reasonable access to the rest of King's legacy.
As a scholar and as interested citizens, certainly I think that it would serve Dr. King's ultimate interests for the broader public to have access to his intellectual vision. And I think that's critical if we're going to combat some of the vicious mythologies about Dr. King that prevail.
Lewis Hyde thinks the risks are greater still, that King's speeches, the tradition he comes out of, makes an even larger point about how ideas and ownership enable or disable certain ways of being human.
And in particular, I'm interested in collective being. I'm interested in making it easier for people to be public and social selves, as Martin Luther King certainly was. The risk is that if we turn everything into private property, it becomes harder and harder for us to have these common or collective selves, which is something we need. In anthropology, there's an interesting resurrection of an old word, which is the word individual. So we live in a nation that values individuality. We live in a nation of individuals. But a individual person is somebody who's imagined to contain within himself or herself the community that he or she lives in. So it would be nice if we began to have a better sense of how to own and circulate art and ideas such that we could be present in our individuality as well as our individuality.
King was a genius as an activist, poet, and preacher who, to borrow a phrase, made hope and history rhyme. But for Hyde, genius like King's can only be fully realized when it has access to the world of art and ideas that King swam in and sampled from. This is our public selves, where our unique gifts contribute not simply to our individuality, but to better our community. And for Hyde, this potential is lost when we confuse categories and place ideas like King's, ideas he himself thought were divinely inspired, solely into the category of commerce. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, BJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, and Doug Anderson, with more help from Krista Ripple. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rob Frankel.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.